This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about community as a factor in mental health. Such an important theme, one that I know comes up in a lot of our conversations and is a big part of really the work of not just this show, but in particular, the work I do around mental health education, of how incredible the impact can be when the general population's understanding is increased around mental health. And in particular, in today's episode, I'm talking to Will Middleton, whose brother created the concept behind an incredible brand that now exists in the world to build community and connection around mental health and finally speaking about it, and literally wearing the product of those conversations through a clothing brand. You probably already know that I've interviewed quite a few people who have mental health clothing brands in the past, and I think it's just such a wonderful way to show up for mental health and to make really cool buying decisions at a time when it can be really tricky with all the factors of environment and ethics around different materials used. It can be so tricky to know, where do we even begin making ethical fashion choices? And for me, if I can start with mental health being at the core of the work of a brand, wonderful. And in the conversation, we not only talk around the motivation of this brand, and we talk about how factors like community and family can be so transformational in getting the right kind of support and feeling like we have not just the support, but the empowerment, the permission to speak up about what's really happening for us. And that's something that I see firsthand, and I get to experience so much firsthand how powerful that is. You know, I'm not here second guessing talking about mental health, because I'm aware just how much of my experiences in this area are freely available online. And at times that was scary, but now it's so empowering. And it took that in many ways for me to realize how often I was holding back, even when I had the best of intentions, even when I thought I didn't have any stigma and I certainly wasn't putting that in anyone else's direction. We can learn, I think, in stages just how open it's possible to be and how freeing that can really feel. And so I was so glad to go through that conversation with today's guest, how we become more open and how we challenge stigma, even some of the stigma that can have seemingly good intentions behind it, even if it's misguided. But we also, in the episode, kind of got to live that through the conversation as the guest opened up more and more about something that it's his second podcast talking about this, and his first time being so open about certain elements of the story of what happened for his family and where the motivation of his work came from now. And so I think that's all the scene setting for now. I'm still slightly getting used to... I know it's been a little while of me doing the intros on my own, but it's still very surreal to just sit here. I sometimes talk to Pete on the mic just because it makes me feel a bit more normal than just fully talking to a screen with wavelengths of my own voice. I try not to do it because it's like very strange to digitally see yourself speak. It can be quite off-putting, if that makes sense. Anyway, rambling aside, we'll get into this conversation with Will Middleton of H Clothing in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, my name's Will, and I have had quite an interesting journey with mental health. I think, like many people probably listening to this podcast and many people out there, mental health and mental illness was something I wasn't really that aware of when I was younger, not just because I'm not experiencing it, but also not knowing that other people, you know, experience mental illnesses. And I think it was something that, you know, when you're at school and even within families and friends, particularly at a young age, it's not that often talked about because of, I think, two reasons. Probably one being people don't know what it is, so people don't understand the concept of someone struggling mentally and it being actually termed as something like depression or anxiety or anything like that. They just think it's, you know, people having a bad day or having a low mood or whatever it might be. And then the other side is people also being shy to talk about it, you know, not wanting to because it's that kind of shame and even embarrassment. And therefore, it just kind of gets swept under the carpet. And obviously, that leads to the kind of stigma and that we see, you know, today in society, less so than before, but still very much exists. So I kind of went through my school days quite kind of, you know, fortunately, I didn't have any kind of mental illnesses. I was, you know, quite a happy kid. I did all right in school. And as far as I was aware, the people around me also didn't, you know, I had good friends. We all kind of got along. We had a good time together. And up until I was about 16 or 17, that was the case. You know, it was very much, I just was very ignorant of kind of any other way of being, any kind of other mental state apart from one that I had.
Sorry, before you continue, I just wanted to pause on what you said about some of the reasons that hold people off talking about mental health, because one that I've noticed, and I totally agree that things are getting better, although we've still got a way to go, but something that seems to be a bit on the rise, maybe as part of the bumpy road to progress, is people holding back because they know the impact of saying the wrong thing. And so they can go all the way to then not talking about mental health, not asking questions, even when they think the other person they're speaking to would want to talk about that. And that's something that, certainly from my perspective, I'm very happy for people to make mistakes with me. I'd rather, you know, despite maybe what they'd assume of this role, I'm not going to, you know, shout them down if they say the wrong thing. I'm going to politely, you know, educate them and maybe tweak what they're saying. But I'd always rather the conversation. Is that something you come across as well?
Yeah, definitely. And I think, as you say, it is that thing of people are scared to kind of, you know, assume that something going on when it isn't. And I think when I've done a fair bit of training in mental health, and when I was doing my mental health first aid course, I remember the lady who was instructing us, she said, I see so many kids nowadays who are kind of confused when they're going through things like anxiety or whatever it might be because of something going on around them, whether it's, you know, they're anxious about their exams coming up or their parents are fighting a lot and they're feeling kind of very down about it. And they have people around them that aren't reacting like that, but yet they're going through similar things. And it's that thing of validating kind of what they are feeling and that they're allowed to be, you know, they're allowed to feel depressed, they're allowed to feel anxious or whatever it might be because of things going on around them. Because, you know, that's a very normal thing, particularly when you're growing up, there's so much change and, you know, there's a lot to deal with, and it's okay to kind of to admit that you're struggling. And I think a lot of people don't want to do that because it's that classic kind of stance of wanting to sort of be the strong kid and, you know, particularly from a male perspective, you know, always being the sort of tough one. And, you know, that's a whole other kind of area within young people that, I mean, actually, I say within young people, even within adults, you see it like the kind of male bravado that exists. And so, yeah, I think that's definitely something that I have seen, and that, you know, there's no kind of right or wrong with mental health. It's very much a case of understanding. And, you know, we've still got a long way to go. There's still a lot we don't know about, but, you know, it's the more we kind of test things and the more we talk about it and the more we kind of are open and accepting of the way people are and what they're talking about, then, you know, hopefully that's what it's going to get.
Yeah. And that's it. We want to interrogate and change these misconceptions, because it's, of course, it's not weak to talk about your mental health. There's so much strength in it. There's so much strength in overcoming the stigma, in talking about things that are difficult to talk about. And yet, even when we can know that kind of academically, we can know that to be the truth, we can still feel the pull to hold back. And yeah, I guess that's what I mean of, like, I'd always rather somebody make a mistake and we can challenge misconceptions and people just don't talk at all, because that's when trying to progress the conversation is also causing challenges for people. And I interrupted you, but you were sharing around the age of 16, I think we're up to.
Yeah, so I came from a family of six. So growing up, I had an older brother, a younger brother, and a younger sister, all really close. And as my younger brother grew up, he, unlike myself, my older brother and my sister, he kind of struggled a bit more in school. He was a bit more of the rebellious kid. And, you know, from about the age of about 9 or 10, things started kind of going wrong. And by that, I mean, he was getting told off in class. He was kind of, people were, teachers and stuff were slightly concerned about his behavior. And he was just kind of getting up to no good at quite an early age. You know, he hung around with people who were kind of, as I said, getting up to no good. And he kind of, he started taking on habits like smoking and stuff from a very young age. So because my parents and I guess the rest of us had never really known someone, or at least we didn't kind of, at least not us, not that close to us, we weren't that aware of it potentially being a connection towards any kind of mental illness, because we just thought, you know, he's a bit of a naughty kid. I'm sure he'll get over it, he'll grow out of it. And as he got a little bit older, kind of into his early teen years, we started to realize that that wasn't the case. And he wasn't acting just as like a naughty kid anymore. It was like there was something that was a bit different. And I use the phrase different because that's what we saw it as, because obviously you always compare it to kind of, well, you know, I wasn't like this when I grew up. My brother wasn't like this. My parents could only kind of compare. And my mum wanted to really understand kind of what was going on. And she started kind of really trying to sort of almost diagnose kind of what was going on. And through kind of their relationship, they had a very kind of love-hate relationship. You know, at times they were the closest people in the family, and at other times they kind of, they had sort of the biggest fallouts. And that was because she tried to understand him more and more, and he tried to push that away because of all of what was going on. You know, as we realized that he was starting to develop symptoms of depression, of anxiety, we realized that these weren't just kind of bad moods, or this was kind of a longer term thing. And just through various different types of behavior that he was exhibiting in school and also like around us, we realized that it was much more serious than that, and that he was essentially mentally ill. And it was at that point, probably when he was about 13 or 14, that my parents decided to kind of start taking him to a therapist and trying to get a bit more diagnosis around it to sort of understand like what was going on.
Mm-hmm. And do you know what the impact was like for him of going to therapy? And
yeah, so I think he grew up feeling, I mean, the first word that comes to my head is ashamed, because he felt, I think he felt almost bad that he was behaving this way, but he didn't understand why. And he knew it was causing a lot of problems in the family and with my parents. And he looked at myself and my older brother, and he, you know, he'd seen us kind of go through school in kind of quite a, I don't want to use the word perfect, because it's not perfect, but in a kind of very easy way. And he thought, so, you know, and he sort of constantly thought, why, like, you know, why am I like this? And, you know, why am I feeling like this and causing all this, these problems when I don't mean to be? And I think therapy for him, obviously at a young age, was, you know, he was quite embarrassed by it, and he kind of didn't want to talk about it. We agreed that we'd keep it in the family. So, you know, even up to the day that he sadly passed away, a lot of people around us, our family, friends, my friends, whatever, didn't know that he was mentally ill. And mm-hmm. I think,
can I just pause on that? Actually, I'm interested in that conversation in particular around keeping things within the family. So was it quite a formal conversation in that way, or was it more an assumption that we wouldn't share it unless we decided to?
No, it was more of a formal conversation, particularly from my mum. I think she didn't want people, you know, I think the biggest thing you worry about is the kind of gossip that's going to start spreading, because the minute someone, you know, you look at this family, we're a lovely family of six, we're really close, and the minute something's like, as with any family, no family's perfect, but the minute something kind of disrupts that, people like to talk about it. And I think my mum was just, she just didn't want that. So it was, yeah, a couple of times it was kind of a, let's just keep this to ourselves, which as it kind of went on and as he got older, because as he started to mature, he realized he didn't want to keep silent about it. He didn't want to have to, you know, pretend that he was fine. He started talking about it as well to his friends, and he realized a lot of people were kind of going through similar things that he was hanging out with. And as a result, it kind of meant that we felt like we needed to talk about it a bit more. And I think I personally, I can't really speak for the rest of my family, but I personally probably was doing that a little bit up until he passed. But then once he, you know, passed away, I think it massively changed my perspective on, you know, how important it is to talk about it. Because although I'm not saying that by not talking about it, that kind of implicitly caused his death, but what I am saying is I kind of almost felt guilt, you know, that I tried to keep it quiet in a way, just because we all thought that's for the best. But actually, through his project, which led to this clothing brand, he speaks so much about how important it is to not keep it a secret and to talk about it and be able to open up. And I could just tell that that had been something that he was obviously really, he really struggled to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. And it's such a challenging balance there to get right, because absolutely I can see the concern that your mum had. And, you know, when you're going through a crisis as a family, the idea of other people outside getting involved and throwing in their opinions. And so often we do come across that as part of the stigma, the amount of people that are like, oh, have you just tried smiling, and all kinds of stupid things people can say. And so, you know, I can totally see that. But then I would imagine there'd also be contrasts with him getting support through therapy and being encouraged to open up in that way, but then leave the therapy room and button it back up again can create its own problems.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing is, this all comes from the fact that we as a family didn't know how to react. We didn't know what was going on for so long, and we didn't know what the best solution was. And my parents were amazing, because they just had to learn as they went, because they didn't have an experience with it. They hadn't, you know, neither of them experienced mental illness, and they just had to sort of take it as it comes. And they tried to, obviously, as with your kid, you try to do the best for them. And, you know, they thought, well, look, we'll start with therapy. Oh, that's not working. Okay, let's turn to medicine. Okay, that's not working. Let's do this. And they just had to constantly battle with, like, what is the best solution? And, you know, very tragically, as with any parent, they feel like they could have done more, and that, you know, his passing could have been prevented if they'd done this or that, which is obviously an awful thing to think. And, you know, we always say that's, they should never feel like that, because they, you know, unfortunately he was just very ill. And I think, but you can only do with the best you can with the knowledge you have. And mm-hmm. That's the thing. It's about, you know, they're the generation before, and they got into their sort of 50s and 60s, and they still didn't know much about it. And, you know, now it's great, because our generations are kind of coming through, you know, we're growing up with more knowledge of it, and that's great. But there's still quite a lot of people out there that are still quite oblivious and ignorant of it. And it's that natural kind of reaction that, as you said, when someone says, oh, you know, this is more than just like a kind of a bad day, you know, I'm really struggling. It's that immediate thing to be like, oh, you'll be fine, like, you know, just get on with it.
And we want that to be true, right? You know, that mentality, if it can be misguided, it can still be coming from a good place, that we do want things to be fine. And also the guilt piece that you mentioned can be such a natural and in many ways, I would say, quite universal experience in this kind of situation. And yet that doesn't make it any easier to deal with. And you're still going to go back and question, you know, what we could do differently. And yet I know certainly for me, something that's helped is being reminded oftentimes by my own counsellor that we don't have control over other people's feelings and other people's behaviour. So as much as somebody can be struggling and we can be so invested in helping them, we can only ever be part of that. There's always them, there's always their autonomy, even if that is, you know, clouded and influenced by mental illness. And so it never can be totally our fault.
Definitely. And that's a really interesting point you bring up about that thing of, no matter how much we want to be able to help someone, it's got to come from them. And I think that was the other thing with Hugo, that he, for like the, for at least sort of while he was still quite young, because he didn't really understand what was going on, he didn't feel like he need, you know, he didn't feel like he needed to kind of help himself. I think he just thought it would either go away, or, you know, maybe something else will kind of help. And that's what, obviously, you know, when you go to things like therapy or you take, you know, certain drugs and they don't work, you then fall back into, you know, it's that element of like, well, I'm helpless. You know, if the professionals can't do it, then, you know, how am I supposed to do it? And it's that thing of, is this a very vicious cycle of, with someone, if I take someone who's, let's say, depressed, they want to be, they eventually probably want to be able to help themselves, but that idea of having to kind of get better and to start like really working themselves and finding out, you know, what works and what doesn't work for them is a huge uphill battle, because when you're in a depressive state, even the smallest things, as we know, are so difficult to do. So there's one thing saying, got to get up, you've got to go to work, you've got to go to school. But there's another thing saying, you know, you're the only one, the help's got to come from you, and you've got to be able to, you know, almost mend yourself. As much as you see doctors and you take things, that can only do so much. And it's got to come from within you. And the problem we have is that there's still so much sort of uncertainty and kind of a lack of knowledge about exactly what's going on within the brain, that everyone deals with it differently. Everyone experiences it probably slightly differently. Obviously, there are overarching, you know, similar symptoms, but, you know, what works for someone may not work for someone else. And that's why it kind of goes back to this thing of being able to talk about it and being able to share experiences and share support and, you know, talk to each other about, well, you know, I've been through this and this is what really helped me, and working out kind of, it's a personal journey.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the illness itself can so influence your decision-making abilities. And that hopelessness you describe is such a common symptom of depression. And so such a, you know, horrible, tricky part of dealing with that condition. And may I ask then, when you think back at the extent to which you understood what was going on for him, what were the conversations like that you were able to have? And, you know, how much do you think you were able to understand at the time?
I think I said I got to about 18 when I was kind of not that aware of it. So then I went off to university. And by that point, so he was 5 years younger than me. So he was 13. So he just started at boarding school. So I wasn't around him a lot kind of in those years. And again, though, because, you know, we were a very close family, I'd come back from university every couple of weeks or months, and we still saw a fair bit of each other. But I think I initially started learning about it through what my parents talked, the way they talked about it, you know, it's the kind of what they thought was going on. And, you know, they would obviously keep us, you know, they would tell us about, you know, what they were doing to try and help him. And then in terms of my conversations with him, I guess they became more open as time went on, and we were always close, but we almost became a bit closer because he felt able to kind of talk about it with me, because I think I'd always managed to kind of have quite a lot of empathy for it. And I think that's, you know, one of the big reasons why I'm so kind of interested in mental health as well, is because I'm always really interested in hearing what other people are, you know, other people's stories, what they're going through. And although I'm fortunate enough not to have dealt with a mental illness, I kind of have quite a good understanding of it, I believe. And I'm always, you know, because I know how much it can, how cruel it is and how, you know, tough it is, I never ever like sort of straying away from that conversation. I'm always happy to let someone talk about it, no matter where I am, what situation I'm in, whether it's out on a night out or whether it's, you know, it doesn't matter to me, because if someone's going to talk about it, they're probably not going to do it that often. And therefore you've got to listen, you know. And so me and my brother started kind of messaging a bit more and talking about it, and he would, you know, open up to me a little bit about what he was going through. And again, I think at that time I probably thought, oh, I need to be able to say the right thing, I need to be able to help, I guess, cure him. But what I've started to realize now is that's not the job of someone when they're listening. When someone who is going through a mental illness opens up to you, they're not expecting you to cure them, to be the doctor, to, you know, tell them this is what you need to do and then you'll be fine. It's just so much power can come from just sitting there and listening and showing that you are genuinely there for them and that you care and that you've heard what they're saying. And I think that's what I sort of slowly started to learn as time went on. And again, I wish I had had that knowledge back then, and I wish I'd done it from the start. And I can't imagine kind of the amount of conversations I probably had with him where he just thought, you don't get it, and, you know, you know you'll never understand. But, you know, obviously, rather than feeling kind of guilty and wishing I could change that, what I've just made sure is going forward that I am kind of more aware, and I am kind of showing that I do understand it a little bit more. It was definitely very difficult not understanding, and you have that guilt of thinking he's got to deal with this every day and I just get on with my life and I'm fine. And that's why sometimes he would kind of think, this is just so unfair, like, why me? Why is this happening to me when no one else in the family feels like this? And that's, you know, that's the cruel nature of mental illness. It can affect absolutely anyone. And as we know, it can affect the supposedly happiest people. Yeah, there's no boundaries.
Mm-hmm. So true. And I'm so glad you shared that, particularly the part around, you know, what it is really to listen, because so often that can be missed, that if we're really focused on how do we fix a situation, what do we do about it, that can be quite distracting from the listening, because we're thinking about our behaviour, what we're going to do, what we're going to take control of and take charge of, rather than what is this person saying? Do they have anything they want me to do? And it can really like take us out of the listening, I think, more than people realise. And I do wonder at times, you know, with our theme today of community, how much would change if everyone could just be better listeners? Like, maybe that's the thing I need to campaign for next in schools, is listening skills, because I think it would make such a difference. And, you know, that's a big part of therapy, how transformational it can be to be heard, and via that to be seen, as opposed to sitting on the outside of the situation and being like, okay, what do I change around this person? Instead, let's focus on the human at the centre of this.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, you're so right. I think although there are multiple factors and things that we could think about which could be introduced into schools at a young age, I think something like listening, it can be taught quite easily, you know, and if you get people doing it from really young, then it just becomes second nature. But you're right, and there's so many times I've been in conversations with people where someone will say something and quite personal, someone else will jump in with a statement or something as if they're trying to move the story forward, or as if they're, you know, they haven't really heard it, and it makes me kind of cringe a bit, because I'm like that's not what they want to hear, you know, that's not, I know you're trying. And then again, it's not anyone's fault, it's not people aren't doing it maliciously, it's as you said, it's just from a lack of, I'll call it education, but just a lack of knowing what it really is to be a good listener. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you also mentioned about mental illness, the reach of it, how it can affect everyone, there is no boundaries to this. Do you mind me asking, were there assumptions that you came across as a family where certain privileges existed and certain options, like being able to go to boarding school? Did you come across assumptions in yourselves or, you know, people outside the family that maybe this kind of stuff wouldn't have affected you, or it maybe took you by surprise in some ways, the way he was struggling, even with certain things like, you know, a good education and a family life that sounds so loving?
Yeah, definitely. I think, and I think it is that kind of misconception that, you know, from the outside, we are that kind of, we were one of those very fortunate families, you know, lived in a nice house, were able to afford to go to boarding school. We all, you know, were very loving. And there was, and that's the thing, it's that thing of like, there's no reason, therefore, for someone in the family to not be okay, because you've got everything going around you, you've got everything going for you. And that is obviously one of the kind of worst assumptions to make regarding mental health, because as we've seen with so many celebrities and people in the public eye who have supposedly got everything coming out left, right and centre with all their struggles. And so, yeah, I think, I personally don't think I ever made the assumption that this doesn't make sense. You know, why is he like this when our life is like this? I think there may have been assumptions from other people in the family at the beginning, kind of thinking this doesn't make sense, you know. But I personally, I think, was always more aware of the fact that it can attack anyone. And as I said, when I got to university, not only through my little brother, but also people around me, some of the friends I started to get to know were also struggling. And so I think that's when it started becoming more apparent to me that, you know, people just like me who had the same upbringings and backgrounds as me weren't the same as me, and they were dealing with and they were struggling with mental illnesses. And as I said, it's kind of, from what I know now, it would have helped a lot more had I known it, you know, however many years ago. But I always think with the mental health journey, there's no kind of time frame, you know, it's so much better to learn about it and to understand it no matter what age you are, because it can always help someone. And I think when it happens to someone in your own family, you know, you, because you're the closest to them, you want to be able to help, you want to be able to say the right things, and you feel it's almost a duty to you. And that's obviously was massively exacerbated with my parents, because they are the parents, and the fact that we couldn't do that obviously really broke us. And unfortunately, as well as with particularly mental illnesses like depression, it can obviously cause the person to, you know, behave and act quite differently and sometimes quite aggressively, and it causes a lot of problems in a family. And I think because we've been this kind of very close, you know, not many problems, at least while we grew up, me and my older brother, when that started coming between us and it started causing fights and arguments and problems between members of the family, it goes back to that thing of, well, what's causing this? Oh, well, it's his illness. It's, you know, and that's the thing. It was his illness that was the problem, not him. And I think he sometimes felt like he was causing the problems. He was the focal point of all those issues. But we had to keep reminding ourselves that it wasn't him. You know, you are not your mental illness. That's just something that's happening to you. And I think, but that we were all guilty of sometimes forgetting that and getting frustrated and annoyed. And that just goes back to sort of another like kind of lesson that I learned, that we all learn, about making sure that you don't brand people as their illness, because no matter how they react, no matter how they act, you know, it genuinely is not their fault. They are not doing it intentionally, but they obviously can't control it.
Yeah, so true. And I particularly loved what you said there around the importance of understanding mental health better at any point, rather than focusing on, oh, why didn't I know sooner? Why didn't I understand more when we live in a society where stigma is so prevalent? You know, that worries me that that could be a distraction, that people beating themselves up for not perfectly understanding things that they've not been through will take them away from doing the best you can to understand as an outsider to an experience. And clearly you were all very much on that journey together. You know, you were doing the best as a family to understand, and also Hugo was doing his best to understand what he was going through. And I know that as part of that, he found ways to turn his study of fashion into then a cause by which he could express maybe the things he didn't know or didn't feel okay expressing previously.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm so glad, and we all are, that he managed to find that outlet, that he used his creativity and what he was good at. Because I think he wasn't very good at the maths, English, the whatever at school, which made him feel like a failure. He wasn't that sporty. And, you know, as a kid, you want to be really good at something. You know, you have those social pressures of all these people around you who are getting good grades, doing well in sports, X, Y, Z. And he found it through his creative side. He was very, very artistic and he was amazing at it. And he started this whole idea when he went to fashion college when he was 17. And that's kind of where it was all born out of. That's where this whole concept of fashion and mental health being put together was created. And he spent, you know, months on it, and it was incredible. But at the time, I think we weren't, until it came out and he had a finished product, I particularly wasn't aware of, you know, how deep it really went and how much he was thinking about it and wanting to express it. And so, as much as it was obviously incredibly tragic that he died unexpectedly, at least he had a chance to create something before that point where he felt fulfillment and achievement, and more importantly, that he had a way that he could express what he'd been going through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can see that. And I, you know, I'm aware of my own biases because I do something similar with my work, but I think there is something so beautiful of turning dark experiences into something that can bring hope to others. You know, I've often been quoted talking about how hardship can make us cruel or can make us kind. And that's really what inspires me most about people, is that ability to flip around the darkest situations and find hope and then want to share that hope with others, even when we're building things up for ourselves, even when we're still struggling, there can still be that ability to look out at the world and see other people's struggles and find mental space to be invested and to support others, even when we're treading water ourselves. And, you know, I've spent plenty of time in that headspace, and I think I've been better for it, because that is perhaps the most obvious opposite to the hopelessness of depression, is the optimism for a better life for you, but also how can I help others? How can I connect? Because I know how vital it is.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I really like your point on sometimes the kind of darkest moments can then create the sort of light on the other side. And funny enough, on my Instagram, I literally the other day posted this quote about that, and it was all about the heart, you know, how sometimes the greatest breakthroughs often come from the deepest struggles. And, you know, some of the greatest things have been created from the darkest moments. And you look at, you know, all of these very successful people, artists, whatever, from years ago who've created their best things when they've just been in their deepest and darkest days. And yeah, as you say, it can go both ways. It can either go, you know, darkness can lead to cruelty or it can lead to something incredible. And that's why I always catch myself, what now I do, because I'm more aware of it. But when sometimes the people who are meanest or the ones who say the quite harsh things and they have that aura about them where they, you know, they just constantly want to put that shield up by acting like they're the kind of the macho person, the person that can shout the loudest, you actually have to stop and think they're doing this because they're hiding something, because they're going through something themselves. And rather than, you know, butting heads with it, you almost have to say, you know, is everything okay? Are you okay? Because you would only speak like that, you would only say that, you would only do that if there was something kind of not quite right there. Because the people who are, you know, the people out there who are quite gentle and calm and kind are the ones who actually are probably sometimes the ones who have kind of dealt, they understand what they're going through and they're very aware of, they're very good at self-reflection. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of people out there who haven't had time to kind of look inward are the ones who sometimes outwardly seem okay, and they're the ones who, as I said, who can be quite difficult to be around, but deep down they're actually struggling quite a lot. And that's what we as a society and this whole thing about a community, we've got to be able to do, is recognise that. And
yeah, and it can be such a superpower once you do learn that, and you can see through a lot of the aggression and other forms in which struggle can come across in a way that would naturally push people away. You know, only the other day I was waiting for a train and someone kind of clearly like flustered and angry sat down like a kind of next to me, like a few seats across on a bench. And I can't remember what they said to me, but they said something rude as they sat down. And I guess I intuited enough about the situation that I asked him how his day was and if everything was okay. And it turned out he was on his way home because he'd got a call from the guards that he'd been burgled. You know, that was hence the mood. And so then, you know, while we waited for the train, I was able to talk that through with him, and he went away feeling calmer and a bit embarrassed that he'd been rude to me. And I find myself connecting with people like that all the time now, because I can see past a lot of, like you describe, the bravado that can particularly come up with men. And it's nice, but it also, yeah, you know, you can't help but wonder, like, what if we could all be like that? What if we could all have that superpower? And I know that that's something that you really try and share through how you've taken on the torch of Hugo's work. And so do you mind sharing just a little bit about the aftermath of his passing, on, you know, family life, and then how you're finding community through the work now and continuing really his legacy?
Sure. So obviously after his passing, you know, it was incredibly, as anyone who had been through grief will know, was, you know, one of the worst things you can go through. And it was incredibly, incredibly tough for the family. And I think, again, going back to the fact that we were a close family and that that helped a lot. But also what was really nice is that we had such good support from our wider friends and family friends. And yeah, literally as a community, they kind of all came together and supported us and have ever since. And that really, really helped to kind of get through it. And so at the time, just after it, I was working in a job in the city, and it felt like something had to change because of what we had just been through. I felt like I didn't just want to plod along in this job, which I wasn't really enjoying. And I felt like something had to change, and that I also felt myself changing. I think because I was going through grief, because I'd never experienced something like that, I knew that I couldn't just sort of go back to life and just go back to normality, because it wasn't normal. You know, life wasn't normal anymore. And to an extent, life never will be normal again, because once you've lost someone close to you, it never goes away. You learn to manage it and you get better at managing with it. And it maybe it becomes less frequent, the kind of days when you struggle, but it will always be there. And I was aware that his project was sat in our house and nothing was really happening with it. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't know what I want to do, but I know I want to do something which has a bit of a purpose. And I didn't land on his project straight away. It took me a good year of exploring and finding out to eventually come back to something that had been sitting there the whole time, that had been sort of staring me in the face. And I remember the day that I spoke to my parents about it. And I said, look, you know, I want to have a bit of a change. I want to leave this job and I'm not sure what I want to do. Why don't I give it a go and try and take on his project and make it a real thing? You know, we could do, you know, he's created the backbone. The backbone is there. He's done a lot of the work already. It just needs kind of the business side to come in. And my parents at first were obviously a little bit apprehensive. They thought, you know, you've never been in fashion before. You've never even worked in like anything in mental health. Like, how are you going to even think about taking this on? And I think we kind of all came to the agreement that it didn't really matter that I didn't know, and that it was going to be a big leap. It was more that because there was such a personal story and it had come from Hugo, it had come from our family, and he put so much work into it. We kind of just knew that if I was able to put everything into it and I had that passion behind it and the support from my parents and my family, that at least we just do the best we can and see where it takes us. And so they said, fine, if you're gonna take this on, then you've got to put everything into it and we'll support you 100%. And so I did. I just started working on it. And it was the first time I fully looked through his project, and it was incredible. I mean, for the time, he was 18, 19, incredible, incredible piece of work. And it just opened up this world for me, particularly within the mental health side of things. And I just became so interested and so passionate about it. And I just wanted to learn as much as I could about it. And that's what I did for the next 12 or so months. I just started spending every single day on it. I was still at work, so I was doing it in my free time. And I quit my job a couple of months in and then took it on full time and just went through the whole process of starting a fashion brand, but obviously the mental health fashion brand. And here we are now, where it's, you know, I launched it about 4 or 5 months ago, and there is so much still to come. There's so much in the pipelines. There's so much of his project that I haven't even touched yet, which is, I'm so excited to kind of release over time. And the whole thing around it, which is what he talked about, is, yeah, this idea of community, this thing that mental health impacts one in four of us. You can't go through life without knowing someone who's affected by it. And the only way that we're going to tackle this is if we do it together. And we need to be able to come together to support each other. And obviously his idea being doing that through the means of clothing, using fashion as that stepping stone to address that mental health crisis, to be able to encourage those conversations, to make sure people know that they are not alone. And that was one of his, he wrote this sort of opening page in his project that just said, we want to make sure that no one ever faces mental illness alone ever again. And that's what our kind of purpose is. That's what H Clothing is all about, making sure that, you know, we are helping those around us who are going through whatever they are, that they're not alone, that they can talk to us, that we can build that community. And we want that to become organic and be built by the community itself. You know, I don't want to put a box around it and say, this is what's going to happen, this is when we're going to meet up, this is what we're going to talk about. It's more, I want this to come from you guys. I want my followers, my customers, my community to be able to create it themselves. What do they want to see? What do they want to be hearing about? And this goes back to why it focuses around young people, because they're the people that are experiencing it from a very young age, and they're the ones that can really drive it. You know, this generation is much better at talking about it. And, you know, my brother was 19 years old and he came up with this whole concept. People of that age, there's no age limit. I know people say, oh, you know, there's, you know, the better ideas and the more success is going to come from people who are more knowledgeable, who have more experience, who are older. But I think in this instance, I completely disagree with that. I think it can so easily come from absolutely mm-hmm. anyone. And, you know, everything about this brand has come from young people themselves. All the designs we have, you know, they came from two girls that knew my brother that are at university. They created all the designs and other bits as well that have come from other young people. And I love that. I think we want to have that two-way street with this brand, because that's how you're going to really build like a really strong community.
I love that. And I totally agree. I think Gen Z have so much to teach us about mental health and, you know, how to kind of push these conversations forward and really normalize them. And, you know, that stat you gave there of the 1 in 4, that it's a stat from the mental health charity Mind. It's one that I used to use so often, and now I don't anymore. And part of it is what you've highlighted there of, okay, so there's the stat is 1 in 4 people will experience mental illness in any given year. But that only scratches the surface on the impact. Because like you said, okay, but those 1 in 4 know people. And there's also a group of people that are experiencing symptoms that impact their life, but aren't potentially diagnosable. You know, maybe they only have 1 or 2 symptoms, or maybe the severity doesn't quite hit certain quotas. The support and the conversation still needs to reach them. People that are grieving because they've lost someone to mental illness, the support should also be there. The conversation should also be there. And so, you know, really, it's the 4 in 4 that are impacted by mental illness. And I love that, you know, that approach you have there and that aim of HITS. We can't eradicate mental illness. It's part of what makes us human, but the help should also be there. The conversation can also be there. Yes, nobody should be dealing with this alone. And so, yeah, I love the work. Love that you've got to continue this vision that Hugo had. And it sounds like through that process, you've got to know him maybe in a whole new way.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that for me has also been a part of my grieving process. It's working on this project. Exactly as you said, it's almost brought me closer to him in a way. It's made me understand him more. And as I said, I wish I could have told him all of this back then. I wish I could have properly sat down with him and spoken about it all and gone through the project with him and understood it then and told him how amazing it was. I mean, we did, obviously. We all said at the time, you know, you've got to take this on. You've got to make this a real thing. And he was like, oh, I've got no idea how to start a business. So, but the fact that it is his legacy is a really nice sentiment. And I think, although there's times when it's tough because it's, you know, there's times when I think, I wish he was here so he could guide me a bit because he's the creative one. I'm not as creative as he was. And, you know, there's obviously you have the doubts and whether what I'm trying to do is I'm taking on too much. You know, the mental health crisis is a massive thing. And that goes back to the point that it doesn't matter how big a kind of goal you're trying to hit. It's every single kind of journey starts with that one step. It's that first little step. And it's much better to take the step than not to take the step at all. And, you know, there's no rush. I mean, obviously, everything we're doing is, you know, it's going to take time to build up for people to recognise what the brand is. And mental health is a very sensitive topic, so people aren't going to dive in head first. They need to be able to trust the brand. They need to be able to trust the process. But it goes back to that point of, as you said, the support. And that talking literally can be half the battle sometimes. Just getting someone to be able to open up can be such a big part of their recovery, because when they finally feel like someone's listening and that people out there want to help them, that can really help them. And that's what we're trying to promote as much as possible, is we can at least start that process by talking and by helping each other and coming together.
For sure. Because whilst there is such scale to the mental health crisis, that's no reason not to do something. And there are so many Hugos out there that you can reach with this and have that positive impact. And I sometimes even tease guests about this, because there can be this kind of cliche of, if I help one person, and actually it's so achievable to help so many more people. And, you know, you're already there. So I think keep it up. I think you're doing great. And I'm so, so glad you had this conversation with me.
No, thank you. I've loved it.
And so before we wrap up, could you share a bit about where people can find the brand online?
Our website is just hclothing.com. Our biggest social media platforms are on Instagram and TikTok. So our tag, our handle, sorry, is at hclothingco. So you can find us on there. And we're also kind of dotted around in various markets across the year and stuff. So we'll always be promoting those.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I will add to that and personally plug one of the designs, which is inspired by the concept of our mind being a garden that we can work on, we can tend to. And that's very similar to the idea behind the branding that we have on the podcast artwork as well. So I was like, oh, there we go, like minds. I also didn't realize, but it turns out you included a quote that partly described the concept of that artwork. And I didn't realize it was from the Bible. So there's me being accidentally even more religious than I thought I was with some of the stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's the kind of story of that is incredible. The girl who came up with it is really cool. Like the way she started, the first drawing she ever did of it, and then like the evolution of it becoming like that final drawing is really powerful. And that's what our kind of, we always try to do with our designs, is like looking at them at a glance, you don't know, but as you read deeper and go between the lines, there's all those connections you can make. And it's kind of, as with all artwork, it's kind of down to your own, you know, you make it what you want it to be, you know, it's which is really nice. So we've had lots of different kind of opinions and reflections on all the different designs.
Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. So there's something for our listeners to go check out, a similar concept to our artwork, but a different application. So yeah, good fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bobby. It's been really, really good.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.